You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Thank you for joining us this Christmas Eve. We should say happy Christmas to you. Our studio guest today is Una McCormack. She's the author of Star Trek and Doctor Who novels. We'll also be hearing from Anne Cleves. She writes the Shetland novels. You may have seen those televised. And also Gwyn Glasford and Frances Spufford will be telling us what it's like to be on the shortlist for the Costa First Novel Award. But Una, welcome and happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Thanks for inviting me, Lee.
Oh, nice to see you again. We have had you as a Bookmark guest before, but a lot has happened in, the, I think, 2 years.
Yeah, it's been a busy 2 years. Yeah.
And a successful 2 years.
Not bad. Yeah. All right.
Projective as well.
No prize shortlisting. But,
no,
you know,
prize. It's a matter of time.
I'm sure.
Well, you write Doctor Who at Star Trek novels, and we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But I was thinking back to growing up. I remember my Tomorrow People novel.
Oh, indeed. Yes.
So there's always been that cross-fertilisation between TV and
absolutely,
literature.
Yeah. And I think you'll find that lots of people of my advanced age who are writing either Doctor Who novels or writing for the show grew up on reading novels as a kid by a very prolific author called Terence Dix, who studied at Queen's, actually, under Leavis, and then went off and wrote a load of kind of children's books. But we all read these books as kids, and I think they supported and informed and fertilised our imagination. So, yeah, there's always been that crossover.
And does each take something from the other, do you think? You know, you can, if you read a book based on a TV show and then watch the TV show having read the book, can it inform, boost it? Does it alter the reading,
the viewing?
Oh, absolutely.
And I think, didn't Colin Dexter have to sort of alter Morse and Lewis a little bit? I think they became much more clearly John Thor and I've forgotten his name. Kevin Whateley. Isn't Lewis originally sort of big Welshman of much greater age? The Jaguar starts popping out. I think that's quite simple, but yes, people start to imagine that actor and that character into it, so they can reflect into each other, feed into each other in multiple ways, I think.
Are there different audiences? Because some people will read a science fiction novel, maybe not watch the show, and vice versa.
I suspect that people who are buying and reading Doctor Who and Star Trek novels are going to be viewers of the show. So not that way, but it'd be hard to say with Morse, but surely everyone who's read an Inspector Morse novel has watched an episode of Inspector. Of course, it's not been on for a long time. So, there's another way, of course, it influenced it. Of course, it span out into Lewis and Endeavour, didn't it? So it kind of spawned new TV shows. But surely most people will have seen an episode of Morse if they've read a novel and vice versa.
You would have thought so.
You'd think so, yeah.
Well, we'll be talking to you much more about that because we'll also touch on it with Anne Cleves and her Shetland series. And as I say, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Fairport Convention and Come All Ye. Why this one?
I picked this one because it's Come All Ye Rolling Minstrels, Together We Shall... you'll hear the lyrics in a minute. But it seems to me a kind of manifesto for artistic people. It's about rouse the spirit of the earth. It's about what you do when you're trying to be creative, partly to engage, to get yourself going, but partly to give you that energy which you want to put into your books and inspire or engage the people who are reading it. Also, I read an article the other day that said it was a joke on Daily Mash or something that cafe putting on Fairport Convention to drive the hipsters away. So it's possibly the least cool thing I could have thought of. I love this song. I unashamedly and unironically love Fairport. I think they're brilliant.
Well, enjoy. That's Fairport Convention and Come All You, the first choice of music today on Bookmark of our studio guest Una McCormack. Una is the author of 7 Star Trek novels and 2 Doctor Who novels and several short stories. The Crimson Shadow, the second novel in the Next Generation Deep Space Nine crossover series, was a New York Times bestseller. She's also a prolific fan fiction writer and a lecturer in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin University. Well, Una, one of the things that's happened since we last spoke was that New York Times bestseller listing. That must have been very exciting.
Oh, that certainly was. Yeah, it wasn't the most exciting thing that happened to me that year, but it was amongst the most exciting things. Yeah, that was pretty great.
What is a New York Times bestseller? You know, what makes something a bestseller and a New York Times bestseller?
It is simply if it appears on the New York Times. Well, it sells a lot of copies, and it sells enough copies for the New York Times to list it as one of the best-selling copies that week. So I zoomed in at number 17, and there I stayed for a week, and then I plopped out again. But that's enough.
That is enough.
Like my editor said, it's like an Oscar. They can't take that away from you. So I suppose it shows you've... A lot of people have at least bought your book, if not necessarily read it. So,
is it quite unusual for something like that kind of book to be on the bestseller list?
Not really. I think there were 5 books in that series, and I think we all went in. Not every Star Trek book goes in there. I mean, mass market paperbacks, by the very description, are going to sell quite a lot of copies. Not necessarily. So it was nice to know that the series had been well promoted, that people had liked the first book sufficient to, you know, come out and buy mine, and then it kept on for the rest of the series. So I felt we all, the 5 of us who were involved in that series and the editor Margaret Cock, I think we all felt like we'd done something quite special with it, and that we'd got a nice little accolade. And I tell you, it's all over the covers of my books. And New York Times best, New York Times, and it just happens to fall into. Did I mention that? It was a really nice thing to get. I was particularly proud of the book as well. So it was nice that it was for a book that I was particularly pleased with, I think. Yeah.
Well, if you can just, we mentioned fan fiction there as well. Mm. If you can just define the difference. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious, but let's just put it on the table. The difference between writing a Doctor Who novel and writing fan fiction.
Well, both of these involve using the setting or characters created by somebody else. The most important thing about fan fiction is that you are not paid to do it. You're not licensed. You've not been contracted, you've not signed a contract with the owners of the franchise or the property. So you're doing it not for profit. I don't really write fan fiction anymore. I can't really read it anymore because it brings me into sort of copyright issues. But I am I have a PhD student at the moment who is writing a fan fiction novel. So we're thinking a lot about issues of authorship, creativity based on shared, circulated stories. What you can do in a novel, what your aesthetic is in these kinds of storytelling. Fan fiction tends to focus on intimacy. It takes quite fast-moving franchises and slows them down so that writers can linger over the psychological moments of depth and intimacy between characters. So I think, most importantly, you're not paid, and critically, but also I think there is a different aesthetic or a different set of issues that writers want to explore in fan fiction. Sadly, I can't read as much as I used to, and I don't have time to write as much as I used to, but it's certainly where I come from and my background, yeah.
Whereas the Doctor Who and Star Trek novels, you are commissioned to write them.
I am indeed, yeah, and they what happens is that the people who own the TV property, in this case CBS for Star Trek and the BBC for Doctor Who, license that to a publisher, and the publisher commissions authors, contracts them to write novels. So you are specifically, it's legally very well defined, and you're commissioned and paid as a result.
And how does that process work? Are you allowed to do, presumably not allowed to do whatever you want in case it conflicts with what's happening on the screen?
Well, it's what happens is you pitch stories, and then the person who is editing or is creative consultant on that range feeds them back to the studio. In this case, in Doctor Who, it's Cardiff. And Cardiff say...
Capital letters.
Yes, Cardiff. The voice of Cardiff comes down and says, nope. And they don't tell you why, of course, because you imagine anything leaking out of Cardiff. it would be hot, you know, straight all over the tabloids or whatever. So you simply get a no or a yes, but, and if you have any sense, you obey.
So, you always obey Cardiff.
Absolutely obey Cardiff in all ways. Cardiff is the only thing to which I am obedient.
Yeah. How did it come about? How did you get into this role?
Into writing for...
Star Trek and Doctor Who.
Well, Star Trek was the original thing. I was doing a PhD very badly. And to fill the day, rather than to work on my PhD, I was writing fan fiction based on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is one of the series. And I was posting it happily on the internet and people were enjoying it. And then out of the blue, I got an email from a guy called Marco Palmieri who said, hi, your work has been recommended to me. I'm the editor of the Star Trek books at Simon & Schuster. Would you like to pitch? And you said, oh, think about it. Obviously, yes.
You're going to a tailspin.
Yeah, yeah. So, I just kind of fell off my chair. And then we pitched a few stories, the same process. He said, yes, work this one up, work that one. Let's try another one. Here's something I'd like you to work in. And he took a short story, a novella, and what was my first novel. First published novel. And then once you're in, you're in. And once you have a track record, the thing about publishing in this kind of field is that the turnaround is often very, very tight. So things might go off to Cardiff, and Cardiff are very busy. They're making one of the most popular shows in Britain on a very tight schedule. So somebody's going, yes, I'll look at those tomorrow. I'll look at those tomorrow. And then you finally get them signed off or approved. You've got to tweak them, and then you've got to turn them very, really quite quickly, to a good standard. So you need to demonstrate a track record of competence and ability to deliver on time. And once you've done that a few times, it becomes easier to do that. And then with the Doctor Who books, when the show came back on, it was a little late in the day, actually, I thought, you know what, I'll write to the guy. I didn't have an email address. I'll write to the guy who I know is sort of the point of entry into here, and just send my CV and say, here's my track record. And I think I pretty much wrote his name, BBC Books London. That's pretty much what I wrote. Stuck my CV. Hi, I've done 3 or 4 Star Trek novels. I'd love to have a crack at that. And as I say, because I had that track record of quite high profile franchise work, it was a case of hearing pitches and then what they try and do. Maybe if there are 3 books coming out together, they try and look for a variety of stuff. So a future set one, a historical one, a contemporary one. And maybe you're given a few guidelines. I think I was asked for something spooky and contemporary. And you kind of run with that. So that was how I did it. I think once you've done a few, it becomes easier because you can demonstrate that you
can work in that genre.
Yeah, you're not going to have a hissy fit and throw your toys out of the pram because they've asked you to change something. You'll go, yeah, I'll work with that, or I'll come up with a fix that deals with what you don't like, and then ability to write quite quickly as well.
And you're working with pre-existing characters, so you have to make them tally with the TV series, that your doctor has to sound like the doctor on TV. How is that?
Certainly going in, the first Doctor Who books I did were, the first one I did was a Matt Smith novel, and it was right at the start of him arriving, and I mean, we didn't have anything. In fact, we went to Cardiff for the day. We went to Cardiff. It's a real place. We had a screening of what they had, which was... I think most of his first episode and then bits from the next 2, but really sort of, quite sketchy, no special effects, no music. So the first one was pretty much complete. So you could kind of see the Doctor and Amy and a few glimpses of Rory as well for those listeners who know the show. But then the next ones were very, they're very piecemeal. Fortunately, as Doctor Who fans, you're quite used to, so many episodes were destroyed from the early series. You're quite used to sort of listening to audio without any pictures. So and Matt Smith was such a arresting performance from the minute he walked on stage that voice just sort of stuck. And then you just, I'm one of those writers who hears the voices. So once I had that to carry forward. But we had quite a limited amount. I think we all did a great job considering. I'm quite pleased with that book. I think it does sound like him. And Amy also was quite strong and, visually very striking. So you were able to sort of work with that. But yeah, it was
Yes, because Matt Smith, quite different to Peter Capaldi, quite different to David Tennant, just in the delivery.
Absolutely. I think that helped because he had quite a mannered delivery and there was all that sort of visual flapping of the hands and quite clownish. I think there were things that you could easily hook onto and work those into your book. But it wasn't like doing other novels, particularly the Star Trek ones, where you could. What I usually do when I'm writing a Star Trek novel is go back and immerse myself in quite a lot of episodes, and that just gives me the voice ticks. It reminds me a lot of the. It gives you the tone of it again, but the tone was still happening, so you had to kind of. Just hope for the best, really.
How exciting, then.
I know.
What a treat. Well, we'll hear now from somebody who does something very similar to you, Anne Cleves. She's had 30 novels published in 30 years and is a bestseller around the world, her work having been translated into 20 languages. In 2006, she won the inaugural Duncan Laurie Dagger, the richest crime writing prize in the world, and has twice been shortlisted for a Crime Writers Association Dagger Award. She's best known for her Vera Stanhope novels, dramatised for TV as Vera, starring Brenda Blethyn in the title role, and for the Jimmy Perez novels, dramatised in the series Shetland, starring Douglas Henshaw. Cold Earth is her latest Shetland novel, and I asked her if the Jimmy Perez she created is still with her, or has he turned into Douglas Henshaw?
No, Jimmy isn't, because my Jimmy Perez has Spanish ancestry. He was descended from shipwrecked soldiers, sailors who came with the Armada. There was an Armada wrecked off Fair Isle, which is Jimmy Perez's island home, and there were 60 survivors, so it's not outside the bounds of possibility that some of those married local girls and that the Spanish name continued. So in my eyes, he's very dark, olive-skinned, and Jimmy Henshaw doesn't look like that. But Jimmy Henshaw is such a brilliant actor that I think he inhabits the role and has very much become the character.
And how does it feel to see it brought to life on TV in that way, to see flesh and bone put on characters?
I look at it as an ordinary viewer, because the books are mine until they go out and the readers get hold of them, and then they belong to the reader, who of course brings their own imagination and creativity to the character too. So the books are mine, but the film isn't really. The TV belongs to the scriptwriters and the director and the actors who make it.
And do you know how the books have been received in Shetland itself?
Yes, I spend a lot of time in Shetland. I always launch a book there, so we were there at the beginning of October to launch the books and had a great time. We launched at a big event in Mareel, which is the art centre in Lerwick, and then we had a series of Sunday teas the following day, because Sunday teas is a great Shetland tradition, mm-hmm. where community halls throw open their doors, the local community bakes like fury, and people come in and maybe pay £3 or £4 and then eat as much as they can and drink as much tea as they can. And it's where there's conversation and friends gather. So that seemed like a really good place to do some book launches. So we went to a SWI, Scottish WI Sunday tea, and then we went to another community Sunday tea where there was a murder mystery. So we always get lots of feedback on the books from locals.
Is it positive feedback?
Yeah, it is, I think. I think Shetlanders are very polite, so if they hated it, they might not say. But I'm always top. What I'm really proud of is that I always top the loaned books from Lerwick Library. I think it's the only place I outperform me in ranking.
And when you first went to Shetland, did you know then that you would write something set there? Is there something about the place that just invites fiction, really?
No, I started writing, I suppose, letters home describing it and diary pieces, because I first went there after I dropped out of university, so I was only 19 or 20 when I first went. And I went to work in Fair Isle, which is Jimmy Perez's home island, tiny island, 3 miles long, a mile and a half wide, and went there to work as an assistant cook in the Bird Observatory, so a scientific establishment where they ring birds and monitor seabirds. But it's also a place where visitors stay because it has a hostel attached. So I was cooking there, and it never really occurred to me that I would set a novel there until much later. But I loved the place and loved the people. That was more than 30 years ago, and 40 years ago now, and I keep going back, still go back 3 or 4 times a year.
There is something about island communities, isn't there? Something very appealing, charismatic almost about them.
Yeah, I think there is something romantic about approaching an island, and you see it first just as a blur on the horizon, and it comes closer and it becomes somewhere definable and somewhere that you can get to know quite easily because of the defined boundary and the sense that it's quite small and there are a limited population there. And that's what makes it such a good place to to set a traditional crime fiction, because it's a device that's used over and over again. The enclosed community, either in a convent or with Agatha Christie, the boat in the Nile or the snowed-up train. So, yeah, it happens a lot. It works a lot.
And what about your knowledge of the island? Do you have a map on the wall? Do you know exactly how long it takes to get from one bit to the other?
No, because I write fiction, so I make stuff up all the time, and some of the places in the books are completely made up, and some are joined together bits of two different communities, and some are real. So I don't worry at all about, you know, the fact that it would take you half an hour to drive from Lerwick to Bray, or if they're real places, then I try and get it right. But quite often I'll just make things up, make places up. Because it is so small that if you talked about a place with two or three houses, then that would identify people. If I'm describing a very small place, then I'll make it up, give it a fictitious name and make up the people who are there.
And as well as the murder mystery in your latest novel, Jimmy's own story moves along a little as well. Do you know where that's going?
Not entirely, because I never plot in advance. I think it would be a shame not to leave him happy. So, and there will just be one more Jimmy Perez book after Cold Earth. I haven't worked out exactly how it's going to work yet. I do threaten to kill him off, but don't think really that I'll do that. I think the readers would just be so upset. They were very upset when I killed off his fiancée at the end of book four, so I think I'll have to be very careful what I do with him and how I end up.
I suppose that's one of the disadvantages of having continuous characters, and lots of advantages of having continuous characters. The disadvantages is people come to love them. You might be a little bit limited in what you can do if you're a kind author.
I do like writing characters that continue over more than one book. I've done both. I've done a couple of standalone novels. But both Raven Black and The Crow Trap, the first Vera book, were supposed to be standalone novels, and I fell in love with the characters. So they both come back, and I'm very pleased that they did.
Now, you mentioned in passing there that you don't plot.
No.
How do you write a crime novel without plotting in advance?
I think you have the structure is there if you write traditional crime. I guess some writers might see it as a straitjacket, but I think it's more like a corset that keeps you upright and keeps you where you're supposed to go. So what we know is that there will be a murder early on in the book, and then a limited number of suspects, and then some sort of resolution. That's the format, the structure, I suppose, that holds the story together. And beyond that, no, I don't know anything. I write like a reader. So in Cold Earth, it starts with a landslide going through a small house. It washes away with it a woman who's dead, who nobody knows, and she's wearing a red silk dress. That's all, really, that anybody knows about her to start with. And when I wrote that scene, I didn't know either who that woman was. So I had to write the next scene and then the next scene in an attempt to try and find out who she was.
And then I suppose you revise and you can place clues and red herrings further back in the revision.
Yes, you do revise. And about a third of the way through, I start to get an inkling of how it's going to end or what's going on in the book. But it doesn't always work out as I think it might, even at that stage.
And you say the next novel will be the last Jimmy Perez novel. Why is that?
I think I'm probably starting to run out of things to say about Shetland, because it is a very small community. It's only got 23,000 people in all the islands. And I've set stories in different islands now, in Walser, with Red Bones and Deadwater Estate in Onst, which is the most northerly of the Shetland Islands, and Blue Lightning is set in Fair Isle. Community is as important to me as individual character, I think. I like creating communities, fictional communities. And I think I can only do that so much within Shetland.
You've had a lot of success with your novels in the adaptations for TV, and I was just wondering if that gives you more or less freedom when you write those characters, or just writing generally?
I think that's a very, very interesting point. I think if I was earlier on in my career, I would feel it as a great stress and a great pressure, because publishers have expectations and you've got two series on the television, so there is that sense that you have to write a good book. But because I've been writing for 30 years, and for the first 20 of them, I was still published by a mainstream publisher, but I wasn't desperately successful. that gave me the chance to practice the craft and to grow in confidence and to feel more contained, I suppose, in my writing. And I don't feel that external pressure really. I still very much want to write the best book that I can at the time. But I've always wanted to do that, and the television makes no difference to that.
So what effect does the television have on your work? I mean, obviously in things like sales and profile, all of those things must have changed dramatically.
Yeah, the sales and the profile have definitely changed. It took a while because I thought, oh, wow, it's going to be on the television. I'm going to become a bestseller. But people love the TV without realising that it was based on a book. And so that took a bit of time for people to actually twig. And I've just been so lucky because things like, you know, Brenda Blethyn, who plays Vera, is so supportive and comes and does book festivals with me sometimes. And just recently I was in the Cheltenham Festival with Dougie Henshaw, who plays Jimmy Perez, and Alison O'Donnell, who plays Tosh. So I think the fact that the production team and the television people are very, very supportive as me makes that easier, much easier.
That was Anne Cleese there talking about Cold Earth, which is published by Pan Macmillan. And Anne was in Cambridge at an event organised by the Sick Children's Trust. Thank you to them for helping set up that interview. And you can find out more about their work on the website sickchildrenstrust.org. You're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest is Doctor Who and Star Trek author Una McCormack. Anne's experience then is going from books to TV. Yours is generally the other way round, isn't it?
Absolutely. The other
have you way ever too. Ever had it Anne's way round, as it were?
Oh, no. Gosh, that would be lovely. I'd have to write something not based on somebody else's TV show first.
But you've never had something that you've written in a Doctor Who novel or a Star Trek novel suddenly appear on the stand? Nobody's thought, oh, that's quite a good idea, we'll stick that in the TV.
Not that I know of, no. No, it's very. These things are very tricky. I think it's one of these things where you get a sort of slew of Hollywood movies at the same time that have all got a rough idea. I think there's usually we're all fishing maybe in the same kind of imaginative or mythic pond. So maybe I've seen things where I thought, oh, that sounds quite familiar. But it's mostly that you're drawing on the same zeitgeist, or you're trying to be congruent with what the show is doing. So you're using maybe more fairy tale imagery or certain things, but no, nothing adapted and taken back, alas. No.
And do you have a sort of Bible that you work with? There's, you know, rumours, perhaps it's in Cardiff, capital letters, where the Bible is the things that are known about the Doctor or Star Trek.
Star Trek is now the novel series is quite long running and has got quite a lot of sort of continuity within the novel range itself, so that's quite intricate. And what I do is run things past other authors who are friends, and maybe I'll get kind of advanced copies of their books that are kind of in the pipeline before mine. So, and I make great use of a couple of wiki sites, which lovely fact. Well, it's good work, proper scholarship. You don't go wrong with it. It's the only facts left on the internet are episode guides and stuff by fans of TV shows. So they're meticulously done, and they're an incredible resource. I mean, you know, you go back and you. Oh, yes, I did. I'd forgotten I'd written that about that character, you know. So it's kind of biographies of characters that you've invented. So that's sort of where I maybe would get stuff from. But I've forgotten your question now. What was your...
Was there a Bible?
With Doctor Who, almost the very opposite. What's charming about Doctor Who is the flexibility of the format. It's a man who travels in time and space. He's not really a man, is he? So it's about adventures in time and space. And provided you don't kill him or kill a companion or try to be too ambitious and clever, I think the best stories just come from that very simple premise, travelling in time and space.
Well, he is a man, you know. You've jumped ahead to one of my questions. He is a man at the moment. Will the Doctor ever be a woman?
Certainly. Well, in my opinion, the Doctor was a woman when he was played by John Pertwee. But he is, of course, an alien. He's an alien who changes form. There's absolutely no reason why the Doctor could not be played by a female actor.
You think their woman is up for that? With the Master was a woman.
Oh, I think they've been setting up the show to do it. They've certainly said there's nothing. So within the context of the show now, if you are the kind of person who worries about continuity and the Bible, then it's been established that time lords can shift genders, and indeed, you know, people shift genders in real life. So why not on TV? I think it's a show that's very, because it's such a mainstream show and such a rating success. Possibly there's a little conservatism about messing with the form, that television is expensive and it's risky. And so you need to be risk averse in doing things. So I understand why a woman hasn't been cast so far, but surely we're past that now and it's going to happen. But then I thought that about Hillary Clinton. So, you know, what do I know?
Donald Trump is the doctor. That would be
interesting. Oh, heavens no.
Who would you cast if you were casting a woman as the
doctor?
Oh,
I very much like a Scottish actor called Siobhan Redmond, who I think would be excellent. Some people say Sue Perkins, but I would prefer Mel Giedroyc. I think she would be great. It'd be great to have the doctor like your mum. So somebody like that. And then perhaps you could go for someone quite youthful as well. So those are the two that spring to mind. Tilda Swinton would be awesome.
Oh, Tilda Swinton.
That'd be great. I mean, she's pretty much the doctor in real life. So, you know, probably not much of a challenge for her.
Well, maybe Hillary Clinton now. She's such a
She is free, isn't she?
She is.
So I quite like that. I tell you, they should cast her as... M in the you know,
there's all
Bond
sorts of
movies.
Opportunities. Yeah,
sure, she's deciding what to do next.
Yeah. Well, we'll take a break for some music now. This is your second choice. This is Reaching Out by Kate Bush. Why this one?
It's interesting hearing Anne Clewes talk about writing about community and connection. I think a lot of my books are about trying to find connection, people who are maybe lonely or lost or have been somehow thrown out of their way of life. Trying to connect and find connection with other people, and this song is about that. And perhaps also it reflects that I became a mother quite recently and quite late in life. So and also quite puckishly, hasn't Kate Bush said something recently about being a fan of Theresa May?
She did.
So I thought, I still don't mind.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark, and our studio guest on Bookmark is Una McCormick, Star Trek and Doctor Who author. Am I allowed to ask, Una, which is your favourite?
Blake Seven.
Well dodged. Really, Blake Seven?
Oh, yeah, that was my first true love. So that's the show that turned me into a science fiction fan.
And have you ever written any Blake Seven?
I've written a couple of audio dramas. There's a fantastic small company called Big Finish, who have licenses to produce audio drama based on a lot of stuff. Doctor Who, they do a lot of Doctor Who's have written for them. And they do Blake Seven. They've done other shows as well that people would find familiar, things like Sapphire and Steel, Survivors.
Sapphire and Steel.
I know. Lots and lots of stuff. And lifelong ambition fulfilled when Paul Darrow and Jacqueline Pierce, Avon and Servaland said my words. So
what a thrill.
Yeah. So and just to get, I was only the second ever woman to write for the actors for Blake Seven, so I'm very proud of that.
Good work.
So there you go.
Good work. You also teach at Anglia Ruskin University. Did you teach Gwyn Glassford?
I did not. No. Gwyn was slightly before my time, but we are super proud of her, as I'm sure you can guess. We're very, very proud of her.
Yes, well, we're proud of her on Bookmark as well. Gwyn is one of the two local authors shortlisted this month for the Costa First Novel Award. Gwyn's Glassford's book, The Words in My Hand, is the reimagined true story of the love affair between Dutch maid Helena Jantz and French philosopher René Descartes. And Golden Hill by Frances Spufford is a picaresque tale set in 18th century New York with a mysterious protagonist at its heart. I invited both Frances and Gwyn into the Cambridge 105 studio. I feel like some sort of literary dating agency here, bringing you together, Gwyn and Frances. You haven't met before.
No, we haven't. It's the first
time,
isn't it?
Even though we both live in and around Cambridge.
And we're talking about your shortlisting for the Costa First Novel Award. When you were writing your novel, come on, you must have dreamt of this moment. Did you have a little sneaking daydream that you might
be on a shortlist? I think a lot of writing is daydream powered. But most of it is the kind of grandiose, if I were king or queen kind of fantasy that keeps you going during a fairly solitary occupation. So it was still a surprise, and it was still a beautiful surprise.
Yeah, I have to say, I was completely stunned. I mean, I was just sort of trogging around the supermarket when I found out. I didn't even realise my book had been put forward for it. So the news that it had been shortlisted, I had no idea it was even Costa shortlisting time. So I was absolutely stunned.
And when did you find out?
I found out a week before it was announced.
Frances, was that the same for you?
Yeah, you got a phone call from your editor saying, I've got some good news for you.
Where were you? Were you trogging around saying that?
No, I was sitting in a cafe just up the street from the studio, but I made unsightly whooping noises.
And what's been the reaction of other people, your family and friends, and just generally?
I mean, everybody's been absolutely delighted, and I'm delighted too. You know, it was so, so unexpected. And it just seemed to me that everybody was hungry for some good news. It's been such a wretched year.
It's
been
really
one
has.
Thing after another. I'm really feeling quite knocked back by all of that. So really, I've been so heartened by other people's response to this. In fact, actually, that's been better than me finding out myself, actually. It's been lovely.
Have you experienced the same thing, Frances?
I have. And not to get too political, but it has been a dismal year in all sorts of ways. And for it to end on this kind of note is just gorgeous.
Public reaction as well. How has that been? Because obviously there are commentators in the press who make comments about the shortlist.
Well, I mean, it's been interesting. I mean, one of the things I picked up on was the fact that, you know, some people were concerned there were so many women on the shortlist.
They use words like dominated by women, which seemed quite strange.
Yeah. So, but I think it's fantastic that women's writing has been so well represented.
I absolutely agree, but it also seems to me to be part of the normal course of things, that in an award working in a reasonably gender-blind way, you might well one year get 14 women and 6 men out of 20. Nobody would be writing articles about it if it had been the other way round. I think it's... I don't think there's a story here. I think people are just, for some reason, find the success of women still exceptional and anomalous and noteworthy in a way that they really don't with men, and we should just get over it.
And we both noticed another piece, which was about the preponderance of historical titles on this year's shortlist as well. And again, that just seemed slightly silly to me, actually. You know, the journalist was concerned that the writers really had a difficulty with the present. You know, OK, my work's historical, but I'm very much of the present. And although my novel tells a story, it's also, you know, has something to say about history, about how women have been written out of history, the invisibility of women in history. So, you know, that's a central theme of the book. So, you know, the book is very much of the present, even though it's historical.
I couldn't agree more. I think the idea that you write novels set in the past out of some kind of nostalgic evasiveness and being unwilling to face up to the tough challenges of engaging with the present is ridiculous. I think, for one thing, as Sarah Perry, who's on one of the other Costa shortlists for The Essex Serpent, has said quite rightly, historical novels are always about the present. You write them because you found in the past something which reflects back on now, and which now is in a position to make imaginative sense on. I wrote about 18th century America because I was interested in change and American identity in ways that have turned out to be quite timely this year, though I would rather they hadn't been, you know.
You know, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know,
My novel recovers the story of Helena Jantz, who was a maid in 17th century in the Dutch Republic, who had an affair with French philosopher René Descartes, but it seemed to me she'd been completely written out of history. So for me, you know, writing historical fiction is a way to interrogate the past, and I think that's just as valid as, you know, historians and the way in which that they interrogate the past.
Having read both your novels, they are quite different books. Have you read each other's books? Are you going to read the books on the shortlist?
I own but have not started Gwyn
Ah, you see, I own and have started yours.
Gwyn wins, I'm afraid, friends.
Yes. I'm loving it, actually. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you. I'm sure I will love it. I'm just not in a position to say so yet. Bother.
And what about the industry itself? Reactions from people in the industry, from agents, from publishers? Have you noticed a change in how they're dealing with you?
Well, there is more interest. I mean, I think maybe mine's the book that nobody's heard of. So
they have now.
Yeah. And actually, for me, it is all about the book, you know, the book finding readers and being read. But, you know, everybody's just been lovely. And there is some interest now from a couple of other territories as well. So fingers crossed.
How does it feel? What does it mean to you to be shortlisted in all sorts of different ways?
I'm not expecting my book to go any further, I have to say, within the category. You know, it feels like prize enough to have been shortlisted. It's just, yeah, it's great. I keep saying that. I'm running out of superlatives, really. But
it feels to me like a kind of a lovely, unexpected endorsement of my slightly mad decision after 20 years of writing non-fiction to have a go at novels.
You should have done it before.
Well, perhaps I should have. I didn't know this would happen. But it's a nerve-wracking business leaving the area of writing you know you can do for one which you're a beginner at. So this is kind of spectacularly good for the anxious soul as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And like Guinevere, I have no idea if it's going to go further than this, but I'm very happy with it just where it is.
Yeah.
There must be something about being validated as a writer. It's not just that you've seen your book in print and that people are buying it. It's that somebody has recognised that it is better than other books.
That's part of it, but it's not something I dwell on at all. I mean, really, it is about the book for me. It does definitely now, being shortlisted, open it up to other readers so that they can hopefully discover the book for themselves.
Being given the attention of readers is the biggest part of the prize. That in a world with a great many books vying for people's attention, suddenly there's a reason for people to concentrate on yours.
Does it impact on sales?
My publisher said they're expecting the hardback to sell out now, and the paperback's going to be issued early next year. So, yes, there's definitely a relationship between being shortlisted and an increase in sales. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
And what about the second book? Does it put more pressure on you to write your second book?
Well, I'm editing my second book, and I've been editing it for a little while, I have to say. And so the pressure is really now to finish it, I think. But I have, you know, I see it entirely separately to the first book. It's a very different book.
But are you editing it more hopefully?
I think I probably am. Yeah. Yes.
I'm bogged down in the early chapters of next project and rather prone to that kind of the self-doubt thing where you kind of gnaw your knuckles and think, I used to know how to do this, but I seem to have forgotten again. But I'm assured that this is a passing phase and that it'll be all right again at some point. My publishers now seem very keen for me to go on being a novelist, which is great. I detected a faint sign of unease in them last year when I shifted away from nonfiction, where they were sure of me, to this. They now seem happy to follow me where I'm going, so it's great.
And the winners are announced in January. Mm. What are you going to do between now and then? I mean, can you think of anything else?
I think I'll have Christmas.
But can you think of anything else? Or are we going to be sitting there on Christmas Day while everybody else is watching Morecambe and Wise repeats? You're going to be rehearsing your acceptance speech.
I'm just going to put it out of my mind. I am doing my best to do that at the moment, yes.
I'll do my best to put it out of my mind, but I will hanker slightly for news about this. But on the other hand, news about this might mean that this very pleasurable run is over. So I'm actually not in a hurry for the next stage. I'm enjoying where we are now.
You say pleasurable run. It is nice looking at you, both of you.
We're grinning.
You are grinning.
Sitting here beaming, aren't we?
You are beaming and you are absolutely buzzing and fizzing. It must be such a wonderful feeling.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
I'm absolutely delighted.
And I'm going to sound like a quiz show host now, but there is a money associated with the prize. So what would you do if you won the prize?
Well, I mean, you know, this is the other controversial area, really, because, I mean, you're supposed to give it away, but, I mean,
First I've heard of it. Are you sure?
But actually, you know, I've got bills to pay,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do put money aside for writing retreats. I go away twice a year out of season to the Norfolk coast to write with two other writers. So, yes, no, definitely some of that would be squirreled away for that.
Yeah. No, I think buying time in that way would be the natural thing to do with it.
And The Words in My Hand by Guinevere Glassford is published by Two Roads, and Golden Hill by Francis Spufford is published by Faber and Faber. Category winners will be announced on the 3rd of January, and the Costa Book of the Year will be revealed on the 31st of January. Gwyn and Francis featured on earlier editions of Bookmark this year, and if you want to hear them talking in more depth about their wonderful books before they knew they were going to be shortlisted, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.fm, and find our show page there. Our studio guest today on Bookmark has been Una McCormack. Una, we're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly. What are you up to at the moment?
I have just finished my writing the second novel that I have written this year, which is a Star Trek Deep Space Nine novel. So that's just gone off to the editor. She liked it very much. It's gone on to the next reader, and then I assume we will be copy editing that. So right now I'm having a little rest.
Good, and well deserved. And you're still teaching. And you mentioned that you've got people on the course who are writing fan fiction. So obviously it's still a genre that's very much alive.
Fiction. There's more out there than I could possibly read in a lifetime, I think. So yes, I have a new PhD student who's just arrived. He'll be is doing a creative writing PhD, and we're writing a novel together. And then we'll write some critical work on the aesthetics of fan fiction.
Excellent. Well, happy Christmas to you. We're going to come back and just play out with your last choice of music, but just a quick heads up on our next Bookmark. Studio guest will be Helen Callahan. She's author of the Sunday Times bestseller and psychological thriller Dear Amy. We'll also hear from Sarah Vaughan about her second novel, The Farm at the Edge of the World, and an interview with Alexander Masters about his book, A Life Discarded, which is pieces together the life of a mystery man or woman using only discarded diaries found in a skip in Cambridge. I've read it. It's a wonderful read, actually. So a happy Christmas from us all here at Bookmark. We're going to play out now with your last choice of music, Una, which is Space Girl by Eliza Carthy. Why this one?
Oh, it's fun, isn't it? I suppose it captures a lot of why I write science fiction. Fun, adventure, having a laugh.